From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm not one of the cool kids, but one of them is sitting across from me, a guy who hasn't done this show for almost 20 years. And to date, he's still the only person to do this show who has ever been nominated for a Tony for a show written by a film critic. Ooh. That show was the first. Of course, I'm talking about David Alan Grier, who's been nominated for a Tony since, and also is probably, in addition to that, the only person to have been directed by both David Mamet and Adam Carolla in his career.
Whoa.
So you were... You
were, right and right again.
You were the first for a whole bunch of different reasons.
Well, isn't every successful black person still a first at something?
Probably a last in a lot of
ways. Unfortunately, yes, yes. I.e. Barack Obama, first and last for a while.
Yeah.
Let us pray. Accept.
Let us pray, as they would say back in Detroit.
Yes, that too.
I've got to ask you, there's so much to catch up with you about because it's been so long, but... The Cool Kids is an interesting cast. It's you. It's the man who once played Blind Lemon Pledge, Martin Mull, and in addition to everything else, the woman who gave us the night the lights went out in Georgia, Vicki Lawrence. What was that first meeting like for this?
Well, I heard about Cool Kids. You know, the Carmichael show was canceled, and I'd read about it, and I was like. Let me get in this, you know, and I didn't know Charlie Day. That was really what was intriguing. The Cool Kids is about a bunch of senior citizens. They move into a retirement home.
And the co-creator is Charlie Day.
Exactly. So that was the one intriguing part. Young, edgy people writing about old, decrepit people.
But also older people who basically are in the state of, if I can say this on Fox, arrested development.
Yes, that would be a good name for a show, by the way. No. Well, my mother, who lived to be 95 and a half, I can attest to it. Old people get busy. They don't get busy quickly, but there's a lot going on. There is a lot.
And more at stake, probably.
Not really. I mean, they're like, what's the worst that could happen? That usually was the end of everything. Like when my mom would cry, go, Mom, what happened to Frank? That guy who used... Well, he died. Oh. After a certain age, Elvis.
Okay.
Now. So, old people... I expressed interest, yet I was rebuffed because they felt I was too young, which, in fact, I'm 62. I am the youngest on the cast, but not by much. And finally, I was able to come in and get a meeting with Charlie Day and his partner. And that was their first question. You're too young, we feel. And I feel like it's more perception, not to blow, smoke up my own tuchus. But, I mean, people just... I'm just coming into the dad roles, which I love. I'm ready. But I feel like people just perceive me as being younger for some reason, which is fine. But I told
them.
That's
because you're talking about chasing younger women on with so many interviews. That might be some part of it.
Well, that's a fact. But I told them, I said, man, you can wrinkle me up. I don't have any, I don't have any ego. And I also was like, when the Golden Girls went on TV, they were younger, actually, than we are. I think Martin's our oldest cast member at 75. He turned 75 during the show. And there's me and then Vicki and Leslie. So with those things in mind, I think they moved ahead. So that was how I was able to wheedle my way in there.
One of the reasons I'm sure that Charlie Day was kind of struck that you want to do this because, your biggest success on Fox was a little show that will have its 30th anniversary next year.
Yes. Say it again. 30th.
30th.
Anniversary.
Yeah, because I met you the year after that. I mean, I was at Kate Mantalini one night. You came over and introduced yourself to me.
Kate Mantalini. Wow. There's a story. People don't know. Kate Mantalini is this big restaurant on Wilshire. It's since closed, where everybody used to go. The, quote, Black Pack would go there.
And famous because it's the restaurant where the scene between De Niro and Pacino in Heat was photographed.
Yes. And there's a huge mural of Thomas Hitman Hearns. I'm from Detroit. You're from Detroit. Now, I was told the story that Tommy Hearns was there one night And he didn't really realize that he was in this mural until someone said, "Did you see the mural?" At which point he saw the mural and was annoyed, befuddled, and angered, and left in a huff. It was very big. It was, how big would you say, 30 feet?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. And it's him being knocked out.
So. I was saying, and being knocked across several, and like basically it's sort of like in relief, or like several comic strip panels.
Yes. A sad moment. But we love Tommy. I love Tommy.
Still.
Yes.
I still love Kate Mannolini, but that's another conversation. We're going back to the 20th century with my guest, David Alan Greer,
who's
back on television for his new show on Fox, The Cool Kids. But I think what's so interesting about watching this is that you all have such different backgrounds as performers and made your way into comedy almost in a digressive way. I mean, mm-hmm. because you're basically a stage performer. Vicki Lawrence is kind of chosen as a teenager to do this but and to do sketch comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Martin Mull started as a fine artist before he moved.
You know, I knew Martin. I met Martin at the Pickford Shelby Hotel in Detroit. In the 70s. It had to be 75, maybe.
Was that when he was touring with his show, his one-man show?
Here's the deal, man. He was, you know, Martin, before he was an artist, a painter, he released these albums in the 70s.
No, he's actually an artist first, and then he started
doing
that.
Yes, that's true. And these were, like, really smart,
that's
humorous.
That's
when we
played Blind Lemon Play.
Yes, they did
the Suburban Blues
Theater. In a time in the 70s where everybody was platform shoes and glitter, he wore fine suits and sat in an armchair. Everybody was playing, you know, solid body guitars in front of Marshall amps. He had a hollow body jazz guitar, and he sat down. We loved him. I saw him there. I was with my girlfriend, and I wrote a note to him on a napkin. He came over to us and spoke to us. He was the first famous person I ever met, and he was so cool. I just never forgot this memory. So when I hosted Later, which is a whole other show that Greg Kinnear got a start on. And I think I hosted like 21 of these shows. But anyway, he was offered to me as a guest. And I was like, yes, bring him on. Not only did I love Martin, but I couldn't wait to tell him the story. So I told him the story. Of course, he didn't remember it. And then he remembered. And we became friends. We became friends. And I rediscovered him a few years after that because his career as a painter really came to fore. And I started collecting art. And he's one of the first artists I really bought and I invested in. And he gave me a couple of watercolors, and then we worked sporadically together. And I'm talking to Charlie Day, and Martin's there waiting to go in. We'd spoken briefly, and they say, "Well, who else would you recommend? Is there any actors that you would recommend?" I go, "Yeah, man, the dude in the waiting room, Martin Mull, he's great." And so they say, "Okay." So anyway, he's on the show, and I love him, man.
Did they know his work as well? I mean,
they didn't know him like that. I mean, I think that, you know, Martin is a true Renaissance man. So very few people know me, all of me.
Well, but I mean, I know all these facets of you just because, I mean, I still remember seeing you for the first time, sweaty at a desk, the police desk on The Equalizer. That must have been one of the first things you ever did.
The Equalizer. You know, that was in the heyday for New York because there were like five series that shot in Manhattan. And if you lived in Manhattan, that was rare. So you would get work on all these shows. And I was playing that desk sergeant, but I had to go from that precinct to my trailer and my trailer to the precinct. And there was one guy, one beat cop in particular, who was very perturbed because he wanted me to be completely covered whenever I went out in the street for fear that I would be impersonating a police officer in the block and a half to the trailer. And it was like Groundhog's Day. You know, in a 12-hour workday, you got to go to the trailer like, I don't know, 20 times. So every time he's like, "This, I'm telling you right now, I'm pulling your card." And I was like, "It's not me, sir. Please, God, don't arrest me in a police uniform." Yeah, he was really aggressive and really, I guess they quelled him finally, but that was my main memory.
Well, it got better from there, as the saying goes.
It did. I was not, needless to say, I was not starring.
Well, but it's basically almost every black person, weirdly, on The Equalizer played a cop rather than a bad guy.
Yes.
That's strange.
Hollywood? We're trying to make a change, were we not?
People didn't just start this decade.
But do you remember like these old Charlie Bronson movies, like there'd be like three rapists and they were all like white guys.
Jeff Goldblum was one of them. In Death Wish, it's just Jeff Goldblum. Show us the money.
That one mugger looks like he could be an incredible jazz pianist.
If only he could turn his powers to the good of mankind.
Yes.
But this is the question I always love talking to you about, which is, it's about performance for you rather than comedy or drama, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't really...
It is. You know, I'm pushing almost pretty soon 40 years in the business. And when I work, I try to stay connected. You know, I'm a big fan of Issa Rae and Amanda Seales and those guys. And
they probably, if you forgive me for saying this, grew up on you.
They did. Or, you know, they know me. And I mean, it's one of these things, you know, I love music, I love jazz. And when you read about particular, like the swing era jazz musicians, how they handled their careers when it turned to bebop. Now, most of those guys were like, that's Chinese music. I don't want to play it. Y'all are crazy. So their careers died. But the few heads that really endorsed those young artists and played with them and adapted and evolved, much like an athlete or a boxer, if you don't evolve, then you die. You know, you can elongate your career and your significance if you change your shot, change the way that you attack the game, and you use your intelligence. Your body may be waning, but your intellect is there. So that's kind of been my thing. Like, I don't want to be the old actor that goes, well, in my day, when we did The Blacks, you wouldn't know anything about that, Jean Genet. You know, no, I want to hype it up. I want to hang with these younger artists and feed off of them. And it's fun. So it's worked so far.
But I've always thought this being too, is that in Living Color, and I've even said this to you before, you approach them like acting challenges rather than just specifically comedic things. And there was an investment in character that would sometimes surprise you, I could see, wasn't there?
Well, I'm still doing it. You know, it's weird that the training I got at the Yale Drama School is, in a strange way, in Living Color was the closest I've come professionally to that. Because really, when I was there at Yale, we were trained to be repertory performers. That means 1 week you're Hamlet, the next week you're
Guildenstern.
Exactly, or Fortinbrough. you know, Jeppe Hodoff. Where's the Samovar? You know, that kind of stuff. But, you know, you have a lead and a supporting role and that kind of stuff. And it was very much a company on In Living Color. And for the years that we were on, that's what it was like. I mean, you know, one week would be your sketch and next I'd be supporting Jim or one of the other guys. So I've always tried to just wring it dry any role I get, because as a spectator, as a fan of acting and movies and films and plays, I have been so often moved by these smaller supporting roles, and it just says I've never forgotten some of these performances. You know, even when I did The Cowardly Lion on The Wiz Live, my whole goal was to try and create this complete person, this complete emotional life of this character, you know, and so that's what I was trying to do.
It's funny because I was watching you thinking about seeing Ted Ross.
I saw Ted Ross.
As did I.
And you know, that was one of the first Broadway shows I ever saw. We drove from Michigan, from Ann Arbor, on spring break, and a friend of mine, Reggie E. Cathy, may he rest in peace, roommate, we bought tickets at the Majestic Theater, and we were in the last row. So we go with our 8x10s, our little headshots. Yeah, it was a matinee performance. But we come in there, and I was like, you know, the stage manager, I said, listen, can I leave my picture? And he's like, wait, right here. Still right here. And he gets on the mic and says, guys, come down to the stage door quick. I want you to see this. So they're all leaving for dinner, and they gather around. He said, tell her what you just told me. I said, I'm from Michigan. My name's David Allen Greer, and I want to be an actor. And they fell out. they laughed us out of the theater, and I was like, oh boy, this did not go well. And yeah, that was my first experience. But I showed them.
My guest who has moved from Detroit to New Haven to Los Angeles is David Alan Grieve, one of the stars of The Cool Kids on Fox. I'm not one of them. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to The Treatment. I'm talking to one of the cool kids who's about to have a cooling drink of hydration for himself, David Alan Grieve. I want to get back to this talking about character, though, because you mentioned repertory. One of the things, having seen you on stage a number of times, and especially seeing you in Porgy and Bess, there was a delight that the actors got from being on stage with each other. And that's one of the things I think that really separates repertory actors from maybe other kinds of actors is the pixelation they get from being with other actors.
You know, I think you have to have a certain mindset. I know I was talking to Martin Mull and those guys talking about a long run. Now, Porgy and Bess was the longest run I've ever done. It was about a year. And, you know, most actors, when you tell them that, it's like groaning, like, oh, my God, I couldn't stand it. But for me, I loved it. I mean, because you got an opportunity to attack and reattack and strategize and really figure this role out. It never felt as if I had never felt like I got it. You know what I mean? And, you know, with Audra McDonald, I'll tell you this story. During this storm in Porgy and Bess, I was always positioned in this one part of the stage. Also, that really wasn't my scene. So that was a part of the play where you always catch up. You know, you'd be like, everybody's wailing and stuff. So what's up, man? What you doing tonight? I don't know, man. My girlfriend's in town. Okay, later. I'll be back in the play. So I'm in there. And one night I said, because I was always, my back was to Audra McDonald, you know, when she was doing her thing during the storm with She and Crown. And I scoot over a couple of feet so I could see Audra's face. And here's what happened. She turned to me and I just wept. I burst into tears because of this energy and this force and just this venom of the scene and the song. And I'm like, oh my God, this is what I've been missing. And it changed from that point forward. I never went back to that other place. I was always there to see and really experience what was going on in that scene. And it just changed it for me. It changed it for I mean, we'd already been doing it for 9 months. I figured I knew everything. You know, I was there when they created it. No, man. No, man. In performance, it totally changed everything. And I was like, wow. You know, those kinds of things, they happen in a run. I mean, if you do it on a soundstage, you never get that. One or two takes, 10 takes, you're off, never to return. So it's a different experience.
You remind me of something that I think about often with you, and it gets the thing I think is actually a big part of Black culture, be it in music or fine art or acting or whatever, so much of it, it's on almost an operatic scale. I mean, yeah. it's not drama, but it's sort of the intersection between melodrama and comedy. And because they're so big, just because so much of this is about finding ways to use performance to comment on life while you're living in that moment, that it can't just be one thing.
Mm-hmm. You want to get all of it in there. It's funny, like Mike Tyson, who I'd met before, but I went to see him when he was doing his
one-man show
on Broadway. And at a certain point, he started talking to me. I'm with these two friends, and he's like talking. He goes, you know what I'm talking about, right? And I'm like, oh, my God. And he leaned over, and he goes, how old are you? And I was like, do I answer? I don't know. And Mike talked to me for a bit, and then he went on with the show. I went backstage they came and got me and went backstage, and he told me that he'd seen Porgy and Bess like 3 times. And he said, I loved it. The prostitutes, the drugs, the murder, the rape, and the robbery. It's what you said. It was everything. Chris Rock said Porgy and Bess was like a Tyler Perry movie. It had everything in it. And I never thought about that because we were so on this high horse. You know what I mean? Like, well, you, Elvis, you can come, but you probably won't get everything. It's a little too much.
I hear that all the time.
Exactly. But no, man, you know, you give anybody a Shakespeare sonnet, you'd be amazed how much is there, how much they get. It's all there, man.
Well, it's so interesting. And part of this too is I'm not trying to get too epistemological here, but there's an African-American approach to life that almost demands being present in the moment but having mm-hmm. an ironic distance from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of that is in what you do. I've seen you do this so often.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was thinking about seeing you in Race,
mm-hmm.
the Mammoth play, and how you were almost judging the, not the play, but the milieu that character is in
right.
as he was in it.
Right.
You know, which I thought was really interesting. Right. And I wondered how much of that was you, because I wasn't feeling it coming from anybody else.
Well, it's just what I brought to it. I mean, the most interesting element of Race was that...
And you should give the audience a praise as
right,
what
okay.
it was about.
Well, it was a David Mamet play.
Which he directed, myself, by the way.
Yes, he directed, which was amazing. I love David Mamet. He's one of my heroes, and he was awesome. Myself, James Spader, we're law partners. We bring in a young clerk, Kerry Washington. But there's a lot of friction, a lot of... she and I go at it, and it's interracial, intergenerational. You understand? The way I deal with her, and sexual, meaning I'm this man... Black man. She is a younger clerk, inexperienced. I look down on that. I question her how she's even dealing with this. We're dealing with a very explosive rape case. So when I say sexual, she's a woman. Okay, this young black woman accused this very rich white man of rape, and all of that mixes up. So finally, at the end, it's really she and I who go at it. And you know, I never trusted her. I didn't like her. I didn't think she was up for the job. And what was intriguing is that this white playwright, David Mamet, chose to write about that. You know, which is very thick. Usually that kind of stuff is stuff we talk about, meaning me, people of color amongst ourselves, you know. But to have that meat, that juicy stuff on stage was, again, it was awesome, man. I mean, I really felt like this is how I'm going to approach this role. And it wasn't a comment. It was just how I saw this dude, Hank Henry, you know, this older guy, and how he viewed the whole proceeding.
Constance, just think about how often I've seen you work
mm-hmm.
and watching you work live versus like seeing you in the film or TV show. I just remember in that specific thing, it was one of the first times you seemed to, and you also were embodying the fact too, this is a character who is so used to being judged by as being the only black person in the room.
Exactly.
So that always demands a kind of wariness.
Mm. Well, I didn't mean to cut you off,
no.
But I've been in that position. Also, when you're in a room full of white people, any racial question, well, let's ask David, what do you think? What do all black people think about this? You know, it is a burden. It's an annoyance. It's a source of anger. All of that you have, you're put in this position, whether you're a black man or the only woman in the room or anything like that, it always comes down to that. So, yeah, there was a lot of that, too. In that role.
No, because I thought in that role, as compared to so many other things as you're talking about sporting life, I mean, even though, again, that's he had that same kind of distance because he was wanting to make sure the kind of effect he had on people.
Oh, yeah.
And as an engineering effect, and even in the way his entrance, which I want to talk to you about a little bit because I love that entrance.
I did too. That was based on, you know, Detroit Pimps.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, when we did the research in the book Porgy, the first words out of Sportin' Life's mouth are, I want to get me a white woman. So for a black man in the 30s, in the South, to say that in public, that is a murderous offense. You could easily be cut down and shot, killed. and not put even, in jail.
And not even have the perpetrator be tried for the crime.
No, not at all. I mean, so that's who this guy was. He was a bomb dropper. He didn't care. He didn't care. For him to say that then, I was like, wow, okay. All right, I know this. It wasn't the play as much as I tried, but, you know, they were like...
No, that's why I wanted to ask you about that entrance and just... Because this often... You see the movie. I mean, there's a kind of staginess about this or basically sort of saying this isn't real. And you... It was interesting that you were basically trying to say this is a real person.
Yes.
I'm not going to pretend that I'm doing archetype here and using archetype to comment on the fact that this is not a piece written by people of color about people of color. I mean, you...
Listen, I took it down to its root.
Yeah.
Okay, so when we did research, I found this American Life. It was about a pimp and this guy who is a black dude from Oakland. And he explains how he was brought into the life and just how you break a woman in. There is nothing nice or cute and or sexy about... I mean, it's human trafficking. So one of the pimps in this show, he said, excuse my language, but he said, hoes come leaving. So what that means is every moment of the day, he had to keep this other human being under his control, usually mentally. You know, emotionally. This started when these women were very young, 14, 15. So those are the things I put into sport in life. So by the time you meet he and Bess, they've already been doing this dance for almost 10 years. She's run away. He's brought her back. He's using drugs. He's using lies. He's using anything and physical, corporal punishment, anything he can to hold this woman, to keep her and grab her and use her to make money. So I was not trying to approach it from, like you said, this fantasy. Because, you know, as a little kid, I saw Sammy Davis Jr. I love sport and life. He dressed nice. He talked fancy.
And there's no menace in it.
Mm-mm. I wanted to cut. And also, it has to be a different kind of menace because, you know, Crown is a physical, imposing guy. That really was the biggest challenge. You know, Philip Boykin was there and who has physical power. He looks like an MMA boxer, wrestler, fighter. Then how am I going to control her? Just from the audience point of view, it's got to be a whole different tack. What hold does this man have on her? If it's not, it cannot be what Crown has. So that required me to do some other work, but Diane was down for it. Diane Paulus, who was all open ears, and we talked about all of this, Audra and I. And so that's what I tried to do.
I think that it's just, maybe you can come back a little bit less than 20 years, although at that point I'll be somebody else, I'll be long dead by then. But
well, if I come back in 20 years, I can tell the exact same stories, and I won't even know I said them.
That doesn't matter. I'll be asleep at that point anyway. Huh? What? What? Wasn't you just here?
Have we met?
Wasn't you just here?
Yes.
Wasn't you just here last week?
Wait a minute. Elvis, that's wonderful. Wonderful Ebonics, and you should be an actor.
I'm barely a radio host. My guest is David Greer, among many other things. You can catch him, of course, on The Cool Kids on Fox. Our recording engineer here at NPR West, who wasn't here the last time David was here, is Leo DeLacula. The show is mixed by Kat Yours, edited by Blake Fight, who's associate producer. I'm going to stick to radio. That's the treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.